Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad. Robert, do you want to say your name?
I'm just, not yet. Just be quiet for a second. She's good. Who is this?
Well, okay, I feel like I should say it. Robert Krolwich is your name.
Yes, that's my name. Who is this person?
This is Awana Molina. This is one of my all-time favorite musicians of all time. It's worth saying all time twice because she's in a special category for me. And like, you know, more broadly, you know how, like, music is a really important part of Radiolab.
It is.
Right?
Yes.
I feel like it's as much, the show is as much a musical expression of ideas as it is.
Anything else.
Anything else. Yeah. And so in this episode, what I want to do is I want to basically present a couple of the musicians that have inspired the sound of the show because I love them. And also I feel like they are amazing and you perhaps will love them too. And also tell you a story.
Okay. But let's do this one now. This person.
So let me make space here. Okay, so I spoke with her recently as she was in town to play a gig at this club called Le Poisson Rouge.
Le Poisson Rouge, the red fish.
Yep. And she told me her backstory. It's kind of interesting. Started out as a musician, taking piano lessons and guitar lessons, trying to be a performer. It wasn't really working out at that point. So she needed a job, and she wasn't really sure what to do, but she knew she was always good at impressions.
It's something I could always do, and it was easy for me just to impersonate characters and then...
People that you knew, or just...
People, like, stereotypes, or... I don't know if it's stereotypes or archetypes, both. I mean... Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting sound.
Yeah. And then one day I was desperate, looking for a job that gave me enough money to play music, and I thought TV was the best option.
You went to TV to help pay for music?
Mm-hmm. So
what she did was she went over to the local TV station, somehow convinced them to give her a job reporting fake news, sort of like The Daily Show. And eventually she got her own show called Juana y Sus Hermanas. Which means Juana and her sisters. It was sort of a comedy show.
It was just sketches. Yes.
And how long did that go for?
3 years. At the beginning, it worked very well because I had money and I could pay my rent and my guitar lessons. But then I got big.
She became a huge hit.
Was it the kind of situation where you'd walk down the street and be recognized?
Yeah.
Much to her dismay, oddly. Suddenly she was an actress, not a musician. And as she puts it, her life kind of got out of hand. But then she got pregnant.
I got pregnant and I needed to stay in bed. And so I had time to think about my life and to realize that I had totally missed my goal. It was just that I didn't want to miss it. I didn't want to die and not having done what I wanted to do.
So at the height of her popularity as an actress, she drops out.
Yeah, that's not what I wanted. I just wanted to be a musician.
So she starts playing in these little clubs, just her and her guitar.
So how did people respond?
Badly.
Didn't go so well.
Well, it was hell for several years.
She said she had terrible stage fright.
If you're an actress, wouldn't you be fine to be on stage?
It's not the same. You're acting. It's not you.
I suppose that's true, but I mean, you're used
to
having...
No, you don't suppose you know. What I was doing is to impersonate people, and I was making fun of people. It was never myself. And it was horror because it was, I don't know, I was just very scared.
So what she ended up doing was kind of going solo. You know, like she tried to play with musicians.
And I didn't like anyone. And they didn't like what I was offering them either.
So essentially what she does now is she creates entire symphonies of just her. Just her, her guitar, some electronics, and this looping box. She'll play a line, and then it'll loop, and loop, and loop. And then another line, and then a loop, and loop. And they'll both be going, and then she'll add a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. And somewhere along the way, and this is what I love, as you're listening, you slip into this universe of one.
The thing by being on your own is that you can go deeper and deeper and deeper in your own universe and go further, further away or deeper, deeper, deeper inside.
Yourself and you're in the middle of a, like let's say an avalanche of Juana Molinas are singing and harmonizing. Are they the same person?
I usually feel that the sounds tell me what to do with them. Every sound has its own behavior, at least for me. I'm just feeling like a driver of the sound.
Well, it's so interesting. Like it feels like she's taking a bath in herself.
Little by little, my ridiculously small universe, it becomes huge. Anything that has a note or a rhythm, you can make music with.
I mean, are you inspired more by a thought, like I want to say something?
No.
Or no?
Never.
No.
There's absolutely nothing that I really want to say.
Really?
Really.
I mean, you have lyrics sometimes.
Most of the times.
So when the song pops into your head and you develop it, you're not thinking of a story,
no.
Per se? No.
Never.
But you put the story on afterwards, why?
In order to be able to sing.
Un día, the song. How did that happen?
I was warming up for a show, and I got bored, and I started to play. And it sounded like one day. I wasn't saying one day, but it sounded like.
You didn't even have the words just yet.
No, but then when I was singing, un día voy a ser otra distinta. Yeah. That just came out. Un día voy a ser otra distinta. One day I will be someone different. One day. So from that sentence, I already had the whole song. One day I will be someone different. I'll do everything I never dared to do before. I will live in the middle of the country and I will dance, 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 and only dance. One day I will fix the back door, and one day I will write songs with no lyrics so everybody just can imagine whatever they want.
Something crazy?
Yeah.
I heard that song and I got the sense immediately of what it was without knowing the words. Just a sense of like a chant to your better self. You once called it like the chorus of one. Remember that?
Yeah.
The thing you say to yourself when you're feeling really crappy. Well, I had that feeling from this song. So I got on her website, juanamolina.com, and the only fan letter I've ever written in my entire life, I wrote to her just then. I said, I love your music. I love this song. And can I remix it? And amazingly, her manager wrote me back. And he said, totally, you can remix it.
Really?
So I remixed the song.
Oh, my God. Was this guy in Buenos Aires? Or where was he?
No, it turns out he's just down the street. He was in New York.
Can we hear your version?
Yeah. How can I do that? Hold on. Okay, I've got it right here. Okay, so here it is. Here's a short excerpt from a remix that her manager was nice enough to let me do of her song, of Juana Molina's song, Un Día.
Jamás.
Okay, I want to thank Paul Dalen and Juana Molina. You can also go to JuanaMolina.com, check out her music. And I want to thank Michael Rayfield for some of the sounds used in that remix, as well as Stuart Dempsey for some of the music. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krilwich.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
My name is Joseph Thacker, and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Okay, so Robert, you know that like talking about music in a way that's compelling can be kind of hard.
Very hard.
Yeah.
Particularly the music you like.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard to build a bridge. And so when people do it well, I just feel like you got to give them props. And I just ran into a really great podcast that I think everyone should be listening to. It's called Meet the Composer. It's from Q2 Music, which is sort of the digital sister station of WQXR, and it's kind of what it sounds. You know, every episode they introduce you to one composer, but they do such a good job of seducing you into listening and maybe caring about music you wouldn't normally listen or care about that I just thought, you know, I really want to play some of their latest episode for you because they just focused on one of my favorite composers, a guy by the name of John Luther Adams.
Oh, the opera guy, John Adams.
No.
No?
This is John Luther Adams, different John Adams than the other guy.
I've heard of John Quincy Adams, but he was a former president of the United States.
Yes, this John Adams is a composer who makes music that sort of conjures these wide open spaces that kind of invite you in, but also seem sort of indifferent to you and maybe might kill you. It has that kind of feeling to it.
I'm intrigued. Okay. Okay. How does it begin? Like, we're going to meet this guy, Mr. Adams.
Yeah, so the documentary begins, and by the way, it's hosted by Nadia Sirota. It begins with John Luther Adams as a boy playing in a rock band.
Imagine 14-year-old John in a cover band in New Jersey, opening for acts like Buffalo Springfield and playing predominantly...
The Three B's.
Who are the Three B's?
The Beatles.
Close your eyes, stand out this hill.
The Beach Boys. And the Birds.
Okay.
So we started out as cover bands,
And I got bored with that, and so did my buddies. And over time, we started trying our hand at songwriting. And I was a big fan of Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa, the teetotaling 1960s and 70s musician and polymath with wildly eccentric tastes spanning from rock to jazz to European modernism.
Anything gets me off as good as, you know, some contemporary classical pieces.
And on the back of Frank's early LPs, there would always be this intriguing little quote, "The present-day composer refuses to die," Edgar Varèse. And my little rock and roll buddies and I would read that and scratch our heads and wonder, who is this Varèse guy?
Right.
And one day my friend Dick Einhorn was rummaging through the record bins in a shop in the West Village and came across this album with this mad scientist on the cover with a great shock of electrostatic graying hair and these bushy eyebrows and this stern countenance, and the title was The Music of Edgar Varèse, Volume 2. So he brought it home, and we quickly wore out the grooves. It just all sounds like a bunch of noise to me. We hear this desert, this ocean, these forbidding mountains of sound, and I remember thinking, I'll never be able to know where I am in this. I don't know what to hang on to.
So your response to what is this music was just to immerse yourself
in it.
Give
me more.
Yeah.
Which has always been my response to any new experience. And I often encourage young musicians, especially young composers, you know, listen to everything you can get your ears on, especially the stuff you think you don't like. I started to realize, oh, okay, there's that repeated note on the oboe, and okay, that's a landmark, I can grab onto that. Oh, and here's this place where there's sort of a tattoo figure with the snare drums and then these unison stabs in the rest of the percussion. Gradually, we began to learn how to listen to the forbidding deserts of Varèse.
Did that affect the music you guys were making?
Oh, sure. It meant that the process that was already underway was just accelerated. We rapidly abandoned the 1-4-5 chords and the backbeat and the 4-bar phrases and started discovering Cage and Feldman and Nancaro and Paulina Laveros and Ruth Crawford and, you know, on and on. So thank you, Frank Zappa.
I love that was his response to music that, you know, can be defined as very alienating. I mean, Varèse is not easy stuff.
No.
But instead of just writing it off as ugly, he was like,
ugly how?
Yeah, exactly. So in any case, just to skip forward a little bit in the Meet the Composer hour from Q2, John Luther Adams goes off to school. He has a teacher named, I believe it's James Tenney. It's one of his first big influences. But he goes off to school at CalArts. And right afterwards, he meets one of his next big influences.
I had just left CalArts, hadn't yet gone to Alaska, and I would take long walks in the early morning and again at dusk, and I became captivated by this singer that I kept hearing deep in the woods, and I could never find the bird, but I couldn't get enough of the song. I started taking notes. The birds became my teachers after James Tenney. And the result was a series of pieces that I composed between 1974 and 79 called simply Songbird Songs.
what was the translation process between hearing this birdsong that you just couldn't get enough of and constructing a narrative?
In working with the birdsongs, I just try to take dictation. I try to listen carefully to the birds, where they are as they're singing, and write down what I hear. I'm not interested in accuracy, because if I were, I'd just make a recording and play the recording. I'm interested in what gets lost in translation, because after all, this is music, this is perhaps a language that we will never understand. Also, there weren't very many field recordings available in those days, but there were some, and I decided, no, I'm not going to use them. I really wanted to hear them and to learn them for myself. Now, that's actually very different from the way I work much of the time. Rather than working with very specific details of the music and then building the piece up, I usually sculpt away the whole field of sound, and I work with one big shape or image or color or atmosphere that I have in mind that I can't quite hear, but I want to hear. And try to hear that, sense that, write that down as clearly as I can, and then all the moment-to-moment details of the music follow.
We're listening to excerpts from an hour from QT Music, from their fantastic series Meet the Composer. This one is on the composer, one of my favorites, John Luther Adams. Now, after the Songbird piece, John is living in L.A., and he gets kind of fed up.
I hated Los Angeles. The whole time I was there, I felt lost, and not in a good way. It was such an interesting contrast, because it was one of the most explosive periods of my life in terms of discovery. But at the same time, there was this kind of inner gnawing. I just felt lost in the freeways and all that sprawl, that city that seemed to just go on forever. It made me long for home, which I never felt that I had, because we moved all the time and I'd grown up here and there in equally homogenous suburban surroundings. So there was this deep, inarticulate hunger to find a place to which I might belong.
The place where Adams belonged, it turns out, was off the grid, in wild, open spaces.
I went north in the summer of 1975, so I was 22 that summer, and from the moment I arrived, I knew I'd found home.
When you showed up in Alaska, what did you see, what did you hear that made you feel like you knew you were home?
Oh, where to begin? It all really starts in the summer of 1975 when I first canoed across Admiralty Island, went into Glacier Bay, hiked on the tundra of Denali, eventually made my way to the Brooks Range, to the Arctic. You know, there was and still is in those places a sense of openness and space and possibility, as well as danger. These are big places in which we feel very, very small, and we realize that we're insignificant and the place doesn't care if we are there or not, and the weather or the bear or the river can rise up at any moment and snuff me out. And, you know, I find a certain reassurance, a certain profound comfort in that. I was trying to reconnect with the larger, older world that we still inhabit, but that we forget. And Alaska allowed me to feel like I was the only person in that place. So in the summer of 1977, I visited the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we flew over the crest of the Brooks Range and out onto the coastal plain, the Arctic coastal plain, and there in the distance was the ice, and of course the sun, even in midsummer, the sun doesn't get very high in the horizon, so there's this incredible, deep, warm, saturated light, and the colors and the shadows and everything just stands out, and then you get out on the tundra and you lose all sense of scale. I remember one evening with a buddy, we were just so excited to be alive and out in that Arctic evening light, and we saw this white rock out across the tundra, and it was this odd looking thing. I said, well, why don't we walk over there, why don't we hike to that rock? We hiked. And of course, the tundra is not easy to walk on, but we kept walking, and you know, the rock didn't get any closer. So we kept walking, and then suddenly we stopped because the rock flew away.
Wow.
The rock was a snowy owl sitting on the tundra, and you know, it could have been a 12-foot outcropping of white stone. You lose yourself in that place, in that light, and in that endless space. And that's what I want in music.
That's so beautiful.
You know what I think about when I hear his work? I remember when I first encountered Looney Tunes, and the way that the like thum 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 has a sort of an inherent meaning to it. Mm-hmm. It feels like falling.
Well, it's the music of action.
Yeah.
Falling, bumping.
Bumping, tiptoeing,
yeah.
Bonking. All of these things have a kind of musical expression that feels almost like a physical language that we came into the world with and never had to learn. And when I went to music school, it was so difficult and dense because suddenly I was thrust into this world of contemporary classical composition, and it was all about understanding the rigor of serial 12-tone composition, which is like you create these little mathematical systems that guide your choices. And I was like, I don't know what this has to do with music. I don't understand this. And then you hear it and you're like, my ear can't pick up on it. I feel lost. You feel like you're literally in the forest. But then I encountered composers like John Luther Adams where it wasn't about that at all. Something more primal. It was about like the movement of bodies, you know, masses of sound that sort of crescendo, decrescendo, waves.
Yeah, I do think of the sounds of musical forms and events as forces, as natural elements in some way. And it may sound ridiculously grandiose or laughably naive, but I've always imagined that I might be able to work in a space that's just outside of culture. Of course, it's patently absurd. There's no way that we work outside of culture. And these days, so many cultures. And yet, as my friend Barry Lopez, the writer, says, landscape is the culture that contains all human cultures. And I believe that everything we do, everything we think we create, everything we are derives from the world that we inhabit. Our language, our music, our minds, everything is shaped by this incredibly complex and wondrous world that we inhabit. So ultimately this nature-culture dichotomy in a way doesn't exist. But it's been a useful conceit for me to feel that I'm after something that is not, it's not part of a musical tradition. It's not specifically cultural. It's somehow more elemental.
Where does music come from? How does a composer take an assignment like write an 11-minute piece for string quartet and translate those instructions into a concept, into notes, into a score. For composer John Luther Adams, it seems almost like the transformation happens in his sleep.
I try to resist composing for as long as I can. I really want to get at something essential before I start manipulating notes, pushing things around. I try to hold things in my mind's ear as long as I can. It's maybe an inefficient way to work, but it has worked for me. I find that if I'm trying to remember, trying to hear something that I can't quite name, it focuses my attention in a certain way. And then I finally start composing when I can't not compose, when I have to write it down.
Thinking about like the way that we are discovering how memory and the brain works, mm-hmm. and every time you remember something, you're actually recreating a story.
Yes.
So I really like that you have an idea and you are continually remembering it. So basically you're making a lot of mental Xeroxes of it over and over again until it becomes something which is so steeped in your brain stuff that it is a piece.
Exactly. So night after night, when I lie down to go to sleep, I'm imagining this group of instruments in this particular space and what they might sound like and how they might move through the space physically and through the musical space of the piece. And it's repetitive. I'm doing it every night. At a certain point, I lose it and I drift off to sleep.
That nocturnal composition process is apparently what happened with John Luther Adams' most recent and most famous piece. This is a piece I literally tried to copy during our recent apocalyptical tour, and it just won him the Pulitzer Prize. Apparently, John was spending some time near the Pacific Ocean, and he would fall asleep to the sound of ocean waves, and it seeped into his dream. And what emerged when he finally started to compose was this orchestral piece for three orchestras, actually. It's called Become Ocean. And what happens in the piece is that over the course of about 40 minutes, all three orchestras form these massive swells of sound, like these three huge crescendos, like massive tsunamis coming and crashing over you. Talking about the title of the piece, Become Ocean, John Luther Adams said, "Life on this earth first emerged from the sea. As the polar ice melts and sea levels rise, we humans find ourselves facing the prospect that once again, we may quite literally become ocean." Here he is in a conversation with WQXR's Helga Davis.
This is a global warming piece. And I would say everything that I do these days is in some way addressing the state of the world and the delicate and precarious position of we human animals in the world. And yet I will also, out of the other side of my mouth, insist that it has absolutely nothing to do with current events or politics or activism, and that music must stand on its own as music. And I like to believe that we can have it both ways.
It is very, very outdoors.
Yeah.
And it's without, it seems like it doesn't have people in it at all. It has just
openness, yeah.
Yeah. You're floating on the surface if you're there at all.
One of the many reasons you should go to iTunes and download Q2's Meet the Composers Hour with John Luther Adams is that they play this unreleased track of his string quartet called The Wind in High Places, which is just beautiful. Go to radiolab.org. We will link you to more information about Meet the Composers. I highly recommend this podcast. Thank you so much to Nadia Sirota, Alex Overton, and Thea Challoner, and Alex Ambrose for allowing us to play some excerpts. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Stay tuned.
This is Amy Lantinga from Boston, Massachusetts. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
All right, so this is Radiolab. And coming up, a story about two stories, actually.
Yeah.
The story of a composer and an artist intersecting in the weirdest way possible in one piece of music across space and time. Are you with me?
No, because musicians always play
instrumentation. No, this is different. Different. It's not the same thing. It's not like a piece of music.
So I'm not
traveling.
Listening to a lady who's going to play a song.
I know what you're thinking.
It's what I'm
thinking. I know what you're thinking.
Okay, well,
this
is
not that
so
story.
Good, maybe we should just listen to it.
Let's listen
That's
to it.
That's an idea.
The first story begins in the early 1980s in Vancouver, British Columbia, with a woman named Anne Adams, who was a brilliant cell biologist.
Oh, yes. Anne was highly articulate.
That's her husband, Robert Adams.
You know, extremely capable with language. She did cancer research. She actually developed a cell line.
Really?
That I believe still exists.
Wow.
So she was very sharp.
As a scientist, she was a natural. But then, rather suddenly, at the age of 46, Anne kind of does a 180.
Something happened in 86 which changed the course of her life.
It all started when their third son, Alex, gets into a really bad car accident.
And we were told that he would probably never, ever walk again.
Anne decides she's going to take some time off to help him recover, and he does. He does learn to walk again. But while at home, she just decides to quit. To quit science and become a painter.
Yeah. Anne made up her mind then and there that she was going to take up art full time.
Had she ever painted before?
Well, she did a fair amount of it when she was in high school.
Which was a very long time ago, so the whole thing struck him as kind of out of the blue, but he rolled with it, and within a short period of time, she had converted a room in their house into a studio, and she was painting
houses and buildings, little churches.
Simple at first, but then after that,
brightly colored versions of what you see when you look down the barrel of a microscope.
You know, cells, bacteria. After that,
strawberries.
A series of paintings involving these blazing red strawberries.
For instance, a water faucet And out of it would be coming a stream of strawberries.
Wow.
There was things called Strawberry Universe, where the strawberries had rings around them like Saturn and on. And I think there were something like 35 or 36 strawberry paintings.
Wow.
But then she would switch to something else, and she would work all day long.
10 hours a day, making these paintings that got bigger and bigger and more abstract. And there were times, he says, when he was like,
wow.
Because for someone who hadn't painted since high school, she was suddenly
so prolific. And it's entirely possible that something was happening to her even then.
Way below the surface. I mean, on the surface, she was just painting and it was working. People were buying the paintings. She was having solo shows. She was becoming a successful artist. But then in 1994...
she decided, I don't know what gave her this idea. I never knew what gave her any of her ideas. But she decided she was going to do
a painting of, well, this.
Bolero.
Bolero.
Yes, yeah, Bolero.
Robert says he's not quite sure how it happened, but at some point that year, Anne heard this famous piece by Maurice Ravel, became obsessed, couldn't stop listening to it, then playing it on the piano, then deconstructing it, mapping every pitch and the melody and the bass to a color.
Here's... here's one page, which isn't very long.
This is from her notes.
She's got A, silver, A flat, copper, B, leaf green, B flat, metallic green.
Eventually, the painting.
It's quite a large work, two panels side by side, very electric colors.
A blizzard of symbols and triangles, little tooth-type things with marks on them that all mean something, and rectangles and marching.
Back and forth across the first panel. There was a triangle in the bottom of each one of the rectangles, and the height of the rectangle represented the loudness.
It's an incredibly obsessive translation of the music into visual language. And just like the melody in Bolero, the symbols repeat and repeat and repeat, obsessively getting bigger and bigger and bigger until at the very end of the second panel, things unravel.
By the way, her title for the painting was Unraveling Bolero.
And here's where things start to get a little spooky.
Anne did this at a time when she knew nothing about Ravel.
She called her piece Unraveling Bolero, having no idea that that's exactly what would happen to Ravel right after he wrote Bolero. Which brings us to story number two. Well, okay, should we jump in?
Yeah, please.
This is R.B. Orenstein,
professor of music at the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queens College.
He's written about Ravel, performed Ravel, talked to anyone who ever knew Ravel.
He kind of is a, what shall I say, a kind of a living presence inside my head.
So, okay, Maurice Ravel is a composer, obviously one of the greats.
Born in 1875. Papa was an engineer. Mother was from an old Basque family.
As in she was Spanish?
Yes.
Which is why some of his music, like Bolero, does sound a bit Spanish. In any case, Mom encourages him to study music. He goes off to Paris in the 1890s, meets Claude Debussy. And together they sort of invent this style of music, which we now call Impressionism, which was this kind of
free-floating, almost dreamlike, sensuous. A lot of colors.
Very flowery.
Yes.
But then, like Anne, Ravel makes a kind of shift.
1928.
When he was 53, about the same age Anne was when she did the painting.
Ravel is having an absolutely phenomenal year.
Just toured the United States, performed for thousands.
He's at the zenith of his creativity.
And he's back in France at a beach house.
Wearing a pink bathing suit.
And story goes, right before he steps out onto the beach, this melody swoops into his head. He runs over to the piano.
Takes his index finger and he goes, dun-dun-dee-dun-dee-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. There it was.
It just came to him fully formed?
Well, I don't know if he played the whole melody, but he at least started it off.
But here's the shift. When he sat down to flesh the whole thing out, instead of developing the melody, making it super flowery like his other stuff, he decided, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take this melody and repeat it again and again and again, and then again some more. And then some more.
The theme never changes one note.
The only thing that does change is the orchestration, which grows around the melody.
Very slowly.
Bit by bit. It gets bigger. Bigger.
More accompaniment. more instruments play the melody.
But the melody itself, for 340 bars, never varies. To the point, he says, where the performers...
They're ready to see a psychiatrist by the time they're done playing this piece. And Ravel, at the first performance in Paris, some woman screamed out, "He's crazy!"
Which turned out to be, well, not exactly true, but in the neighborhood. 6 years after he wrote Bolero, this is 1933, Ravel begins to forget words. He'd always been forgetful, so no one really noticed at first. But then one day at dinner, he grabs the knife by the wrong side.
And he doesn't realize it.
And he continues to try to eat.
Holding the sharp side of the knife and trying to cut with the handle.
Then he visits a friend, leaves.
Now 2 hours go by, knock on the door, it's Ravel again. He didn't remember that he'd been there before.
Just 2 hours earlier.
Eventually.
By 1935.
He could not write anymore.
Or speak. His language had evaporated. Arby says there are documents where you can see Ravel desperately trying to relearn the alphabet.
A, over and over again.
Wow.
B, with a kind of a shaking hand, very small. It's very, very painful to see.
Whatever it was that was wrong was getting worse.
Here's the weird symmetry. Just like Ravel, 6 years after finishing her Bolero.
By 2000, I would say.
Anne also begins to forget words.
She would try to say things and couldn't. She would try to find words and couldn't.
So how are you today?
Fine.
Eventually, Anne ends up at the University of California, San Francisco.
And this was in 2002, and they gave her a bunch of tests.
Can you tell me your full name, please?
Anne Teresa Adams.
There's a video of one of these tests, and in it you can see Anne sitting at a table in a black sweater, gray hair, glasses. Very composed.
And can you tell me your address?
Like someone who's used to knowing the answers to questions that people ask her.
For... Twenty-three.
Which town?
Mm-hmm. Vancouver.
Great.
By the time Anne had come to see us, her communication abilities were markedly diminished.
That's Dr. Bruce Miller. He's a neurologist. He runs the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF.
Example, we asked her to describe...
Okay, and I'd like you to take a look at this picture.
A very complex, rich picture with...
Take your time.
Children with a kite, with a sailboat on the ocean.
And please tell me what you see. And if you can, please try to speak in sentences.
Anne would be able to say single words with no grammar. She'd go, sailboat.
Tree.
Boy. Water.
People.
Kite.
Kite. Flag.
And that 4 or 5 words would come out over about a minute's time. She was very frustrated.
Both Anne Adams and Maurice Ravel were unraveling in the exact same way, at the exact same speed, to the same soundtrack, you might say, but just roughly 60 years apart.
We think he and Anne, down to the very molecular process, had the exact same disease.
And he thinks Bolero, the music, and then the painting, in both their cases, was the first symptom of that disease. This takes a couple of steps to explain, so bear with me. But to start, the disease is called
frontotemporal dementia.
That's Jonah Lehrer, author, regular on our show.
And it begins when spindly cells in your frontal cortex,
this part kind of right above your forehead,
start to wither and die. And so your frontal cortex is pockmarked with sometimes visible holes.
We know this about Anne from tests and brain scans. We suspect it about Ravel, because according to Arby, just before he died,
on December 28th, 1937,
a French surgeon opened up his skull and saw
that one of the lobes of the two lobes of the brain had sunk.
Because it was disintegrating. Now, in both their cases, the part of the brain, the part of their cortex that got hit, was on the left, which is a part that does a lot of things. Memory.
Recalling memories. Finding memories.
And most importantly for our story, it governs language.
What happens is, as the frontal cortex starts to fall apart, you lose the ability to access language.
Now here's the thing about losing language. Our brains, according to Bruce, are basically a series of circuits that are all tightly connected. And when a dominant circuit like language turns on, it's basically wired to turn a bunch of other circuits off, to basically go, shh, to other parts of the brain.
We have this constant dance where one circuit or many circuits turn on, and then they're obligatorily turning off other circuits.
So language acts as a kind of brake on other things the brain could be doing, like daydreaming, thinking in images and pictures. But when the language is no longer there to hold things back, often what can happen is that those other parts, like say the visual parts, can just rush forward, and suddenly the mind is flooded with images.
That all of a sudden people have these rich, rich, intense sensations. The world is so beautiful, and they need to express it.
This is very common. We see a number of patients who become visually obsessed.
From every possible walk of life. Investment bankers who have never been interested in art before.
Never even walked into an art museum.
All of a sudden they decide at the age of 55 to move into a loft.
Become an artist.
One of the first glimmers of their illness is this insatiable need to create.
That's right.
How many of these cases have you seen?
50, 60.
Whoa.
It manifests itself in as many different kinds of art as there are people.
But at the end of the day, what all these people have in common is that this explosion of creativity in their heads, well, it's not a free-flowing, loosey-goosey kind of creativity. It's quite mechanical.
The repetition, the obsession.
They get stuck in a kind of loop, taking one thing and just doing it again and again.
Like an Anne Adams painting.
Or like Bolero.
This drive to repeat happens very early in the course of this illness.
So he says, what can seem like a simple creative choice to repeat a melody may actually be driven by a condition that you won't even know you have for 6 years.
We think that this had something to do with the very unusual, rhythmic, repetitive sorts of music that Ravel produced.
And why the repetition? Where does it come from?
I think this is a release of a motor.
Bruce says, we don't really know, but he offered up a theory which I find fascinating, which may get to the root of creative obsession of any kind. He says there might be several parts of the brain that are held back by the language circuit, and one of them is this very ancient part of our brains.
The basal ganglia, the part of the brain we move with.
You can call it our reptile brain. This is the part of us that governs, you know, basic behaviors like eating, running.
Motor programs that we do repetitively every day.
That's all it does. It sends commands saying move, move, eat, eat, run, run. Birds and snakes get by with basically just this part of the brain. Keeps them alive. Now, normally, he thinks the language part of us
inhibits these habits, these repetitive motor programs.
But when the language part is not there to do the shushing, these motor commands filter up too. So imagine you're one of these people. Your mind is suddenly flooded with pictures, maybe sounds, and it's also flooded with these kinetic, repetitive instructions. Move, 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 do it again. And in the early stages of the illness, you still have enough brain to make sense of it all.
There's still a lot of cortex that is still available to act upon this desire to repeat.
And so you get art that is obsessive and repetitive, yes, but also beautiful and abstract, like Unraveling Bolero. But then as the disease progresses and more of that front human-y part fades away,
the repetition becomes much simpler.
And not creative at all. In the latter stages of a disease, he says, you'll often see patients
pouring water into a cup 100 times in a day, squishing ants over and over again. The complexity of the behaviors are diminishing as we're losing these parts of the brain that make us so human.
Sort of what you see in Anne's work. Her paintings startle, simple, explode into abstraction, and then get simple again. But what's unusual compared to the other patients is that she kept painting almost all the way to the end.
Until literally it was not possible for her to hold and direct a brush or a pen.
That's her husband Robert again.
Anne became progressively paralyzed on the right side of her body.
She lost the ability to paint 2005, early. And that was sad.
Towards the end, He says he would go into her studio.
And I would see her there.
In front of a blank canvas.
And she wouldn't be doing anything. She would just be looking at it. And I'd come back a couple of hours later, and she still wouldn't have done anything. Hmm. She had lost the ability to do the art.
But she hadn't lost the drive. And that, to me, is one of the beautiful parts of Anne's story, that the drive to create can be as primal as the drive to eat, that even after she couldn't move, could barely swallow, she still sat there trying.
She had gone downhill so far by that time that she was hardly recognizable as herself.
At some point in the disease, and you can see this in that early tape, painting was all she had left.
I don't have the memories of this.
Okay. Painting had become literally all she was.
Can you tell me what your job is, or are you still working?
I do art.
Great. Mm.
She died in 2007?
Yes, in January of 2007.
Thanks to Robert Adams, Bruce Miller at the University of California, San Francisco, and R.B. Orenstein at Queens College. I'm Jad Abumrad. Robert will be back with me next podcast. See you then.
Hey, you guys. Here's the credits. Okay. Hi, this is Kaylee Sakai, a Radiolab listener from Seattle, Washington. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Thanks, guys. Bye.
End of message.